first time, and I thought of this song, which is kind of about the possibilities of human nature, what kind of life to pursue. It may not be quite as optimistic as your sermon, so we'll start off kind of ambivalent, and then you'll bring us up to the possibilities of humans being compassionate. It's not a negative song, it's kind of an argument with myself, which I lose. So. Fear and desire, desire and fear, a ride on the wind, or a walk in the fire, let go and let be, or transcend and transpire, should I try to let go? Fear and desire, I woke in the forest, heard the birds and the bees, and a howl in the distance. Saw some squirrels in the trees, watched a hawk take a rabbit, and a buck mount a deer. I knew what I was, just desire and fear, fear and desire, desire and fear, right on the whim, or a walk in the fire, let go and let be, or transcend and transpire. I am what I am, just fear and desire. And I climbed up the mountain and looked in God's eye. Saw a bright burst of sunlight, not a cloud in the sky. The sound of the wind, just a heavenly choir, so peaceful and calm. No fear, no desire. So peaceful and calm. No fear, no desire. Then I walked down the streets, past the houses and stores, saw the boarded up buildings, saw the sick and the poor. I stopped in a bar, I guess I needed a beer, and compassion and hope. There's just desire and fear, fear and desire, desire and fear, right on the wind, or walk in the fire, let go and let be, or transcend and transpire, should I really let go? Fear and desire, a life of the body, a life of the mind, a life of the spirit, a life for mankind. When it's all said and done, and I finally expire, just a drop in the pond. No fear, no desire, just a drop in the pond. No fear, no desire.
Witnessing a revolution in the scientific understanding of human nature. Where once science painted humans as self-seeking and warlike, simplified notions of killer apes and selfish genes that still permeate popular culture, today scientists of many disciplines are uncovering the deep roots of human goodness. This research challenges some long-held notions about human nature, revealing that the good in us is just as intrinsic to our species as the bad. Empathy, gratitude, compassion, altruism, fairness, trust, and cooperation, once thought to be aberrations from the tooth and claw natural order of things, are actually core features of primate evolution. We hope today to share more about this fascinating subject and how you can incorporate the findings into your everyday life. Our service today has been prepared by LCUUC member Mark Brewer as a silent auction donation from last year. Kim Sewer had the winning bid, which gave her the privilege of naming the topic. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom. Please join with us in singing the chalice lighting response as printed in the order of service.
About church life and activities. Please read the announcements listed in your order of service, and you may take an order of service home with you to read them further. Reminder, our big solar event will be next Saturday from noon to 4. We will have tour speakers, musicians, info tables, children's activities, bring the whole family, friends. Please sign up in the social hall if you can help and take a flyer with you. Monthly food pantry collection today is Undies Sunday. Please place your donations of new socks and or underwear in the Hope Center bins in the foyer for clients of the Hope Center in Waukesha. The Hope Center's clothing shop provides donated clothing to adults, children, and children in need. If you grab your undies today, you can bring them next week. There will be a special workshop for families on Sunday, October 23rd from noon to 2 on bringing UU values into your home. Please see your order of service for more information. LCUUC is also hosting two workshops for personal renewal and self-discovery this fall with Elizabeth Lewis. One on how happiness, on the how of happiness, and the other on soulful aging. Please see our order of service for more information on those. Okay, men, it's time to set aside and let a woman show you how it's done. 20th century philosopher Hannah Arendt will be the topic of. Let's see here. I should step aside, maybe. All right, here we go. Come and join us here at LCUC on 9 Thursday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m., September 22nd through November 17th, 2011, to experience the insight of one of the most profound thinkers of the 20th century, Hannah Arendt. You may purchase your own copy of The Life of the Mind by Hannah Arendt online by going to abooks.com. If you're interested, please contact Mike Santo. LCUUC's annual Time, Talent, and Treasure auction is right around the corner. For this event, members and friends donate their time, talents, and or treasures. Then over the course of 3 Sundays in October, everyone has the opportunity to bid on these donated items. Last year, over $4,900 was made for our church. This year's auction will take place on October 2nd, 9th, and 16th. Donation forms are available starting today. Look for them in the social hall after today's service. See Amy and or Kevin Say if you have any questions or want to talk about ideas for making next year's auction different and even more fun. I invite you to greet those sitting around you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Please help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church or have been visiting for a while and like information about becoming a member. I'd be happy to talk with you about anything you're interested in. If you are visiting us with your children, it's our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they will go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them, or, I'm sorry. So if you're visiting us, your child is welcome to join, Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just outside the door to my right, across the entryway. There is a need for child care during the service. Classes will end at 11:15, at which time you can pick your children up from their classes. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so.
This is my friend Joanna, and she's here today to just visit.
Hi, Joanna.
Welcome.
I brought my lifelong friend David to church today.
Welcome.
Frank, my good friend Tony, and my good friend Ned and her son Brandon. So,
welcome.
Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. Conversation Corner is a good place to gather for further discussion on the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring. Yes.
I'm sorry, can I make one more announcement?
Absolutely.
After the service today, in the social hall, we're doing shared ministry where you can sign up for all the various committees and come here to get yourself a table. And if you don't feel like you really were up to standards this week, you can, up the ante next week because we have one more week of sharing ministry. So we'll see you after the
Our opening hymn this morning is number 86. Blessed Spirit of my life, please rise as you're willing and able.
Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the story for all ages. So if any of the, if all of the children would like to come up and I'll share a story with you. Come on up and sit down over here. It's great to be back at church and see all your kids today. Today's our first day of religious education for the fall. So some of you are moving up to new classrooms today, I know, and that's pretty exciting. So I'm glad you're all here. I'm Carrie, if you guys don't know me, and I can always answer any of your questions about your religious education classes, your RE classes. So today's story is called Fly Free, and in church they're going to be talking about kindness and compassion, and this is a Vietnamese story from the Buddhist tradition about kindness and compassion. So Vietnam is on the other side of the globe, and they dress a little differently, and they go to a temple rather than a church. So come on up if you can't see the pictures. They're beautiful, but they're a little hard to see. It was early morning, and the sun had just risen, round and red as a parasol. The earth under Mai's toes was cool, but the sun's first rays cast a warm golden glow on the pagoda eaves. Here's the pagoda. Mai looked for the familiar cage of sparrows for sale by the temple gates. The birds twittered with excitement, bobbing their comical heads like tiny puppets. "May I feed them?" she asked the vendor. "Of course." As much as Mai loved to visit the birds, she hoped someone would pay for their release. This was the Buddhist way. To set an animal free was a good deed. She would have freed them herself, but the cost was more than her mother could spare. Mai eased small bowls of seed and water into the cage. "Shush, shush, shush, shush." Mai heard the sound of slippers nearby. They were red and belonged to a girl named Thu. When Thu took them off, as was the custom before entering a temple, Mai could not help but stare. She had never seen such a beautiful pair of shoes. Mai waited for Thu by the temple door and smiled when she came out. "The sparrows are hungry," she said. "Would you like to help feed them?" Thu nodded as Mai poured seed into her outstretched hand. Then Mai whispered softly, fly free, in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you." On her way home that day, Thu noticed a girl sitting by the roadside, cradling her foot in her hands. She had been cut by a sharp piece of glass, and the wound stung. "My friend," Thu called to her, "please take these slippers. They'll help to ease your pain." The girl looked up in disbelief. The shoes were the rich red color of pomegranates, and the velvet was new and uncrushed. She put them on and nodded her thanks as Thu sang out, fly free, in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you." The next morning, the girl's foot was much better. One of her daily chores was drawing water from a well at the edge of town. With her new shoes on, she easily shouldered the heavy burden of the buckets. On the way home, she passed Ong Hai, the ox cart driver, asleep in the shade of a banyan tree. "He'll be thirsty when he wakes up," she thought. She quietly approached his cart, dipped her coconut shell into the cool, sweet water, and left it on the seat beside him. When Ong Hai woke up, his throat was parched. To his surprise, a cool drink awaited him. But who had been so kind? Looking down the lane behind him, a girl's song faded into the midday dust. Fly free, in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you. Later that day, Ong Hai saw an old woman hobble down the road, balancing a basket of cakes high atop her head. "Do you need a ride to market?" asked Ong Hai. "Yes, but I have no money." "Hop in," said Ong Hai. "I'll trade a ride for one of your cakes. They look delicious." "That they are," the woman replied. "I made them myself from an old family recipe." Ong Hai savored the sweet coconut flavor during the ride to market. When he left the woman off, he whistled a cheerful tune. fly free in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you. At market, business was brisk, and the woman soon sold out of cakes. She picked up her empty basket, bought a large sack of rice, and returned home. The next morning, she woke to find a lone monk passing her house with his alms bowl in his hand. It was breakfast time, and this was the monk's way of asking for food. The woman rushed out to the road with steaming rice for his bowl. "It's simple, but filling," she said. The monk nodded his thanks, his orange robe streaming behind him like the sun's rays. As he walked off, a song drifted on the morning breeze. Want to sing with me? Fly free in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you. Yes. Touched by these words, the monk went to visit the home of a sick boy in the village. He treated the boy and chanted a river of words. The next day, the child had completely recovered. The happy father went to the temple to give his thanks. Can anyone guess what happens at the temple? There by the temple gates, he saw Mai tenderly feeding the sparrows, singing a familiar song. Fly free in the sky so blue. When you do a good deed, it will come back to you. At once, he understood how good deeds are passed from one person to the next. A wheel of kindness exists in people's hearts. It turns day and night through cities, villages, and countryside until it comes back to its origin, making a full circle. Without hesitating, he gave the bird owner all the money he had with him. "I'd like to free the sparrows," he said. The owner nodded at Mai. Her heart beat like the wings of 1,000 birds in flight as she opened the cage door. In a moment, the birds were gone. Then Mai called out as loudly as she could, fly free in the sky so blue. And that's the end of our story. So I hope you enjoyed the story. And now today, you know, normally we go out to religious education, RE classes, after we pass the baskets around for the offertory, but today we're going to do it a little bit differently. So Rhiannon's going to go up and get the lantern. Go ahead, Rhiannon, you can go now. And then I'm going to have you guys follow Rhiannon out, and then all the older kids can go out now too. Alright, so here we go.
Concern to share, please raise your hand and one of the ushers will bring the mic and tell us your name. We can get to know you better. And I'll light a candle for you. And I'll start off lighting a candle, a memorial candle, in memory of all the people who are dying unjustly and in hopes of finding a better way.
Good morning, I'm Barbara, and I want you to light a candle of joy. My son-in-law, after 2.5 years, has gotten a full-time job with health benefits for the family.
My name is Chris. Would you light a candle of joy for my daughter and her husband and our little boy? They moved to Pittsburgh, and he was left behind for several weeks at San Francisco finishing up his work commitment there, but he got home last night about 1 o'clock, so they've started a new life in Pittsburgh.
Take a minute and open our minds and our hearts to the place of quiet, to the silent prayer for the healing of pain and the soft, gentle coming of love. Tim is number 313.
Rise if you're unable.
morning. It's by Zachary Taylor. He describes himself as a therapist and teacher, as we found on the web. He starts with a quote from the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, and it is, "My religion is simple. My religion is kindness." So here's what he wrote. "Some people teach that human nature is basically bad, defective, or tainted beyond our capacity to heal. I thought this for a long time as it was a view taught to me. I was told I was sinful, and in order to live a good life and have a good afterlife, I would need to accept this fact of my own sinfulness, that I'm powerless over it and need God to save me from it. I've since rethought this. It's not that I have some corner on truth that no one else has. I'm not even sure I'm interested anymore in trying to pin down things like God, the afterlife, and so on, because doing so is a bit like pinning jello to the wall. The fact is, none of us knows any more than anyone else about these things. So I've become more interested in what I sense about myself. And what I sense is that I'm not so bad after all. That the other people I've had the privilege of knowing aren't so bad off either, even ones who haven't had a particularly kind disposition toward me. So if we're not somehow tainted at birth with sin or something else, why does the world seem so greedy, power-hungry, and violent at times? What I experience is that humans aren't naturally evil, but we are naturally caught in fear. A fear of not having enough, of discomfort, of being abandoned and alone, of not getting what we want, of feeling separate from others, of death. But wipe away that fear, and what do you get? Our state when we are not caught in fear is kindness. In other words, when we cease to be trapped in our fears, we can very naturally and easily become kind. Carl Rogers, though using different language, called this the self-actualizing tendency, that when we feel connected and safe, we naturally grow in our inherent goodness and creativity. It's often thought it would be quite the opposite, that the fearless become driven for power, but I would say those sort of actions betray deep underlying fears and insecurities. This, I think, is why the Dalai Lama has said numerous times that my religion is kindness, and that the essence of a holy life is the expression of that kindness. For him and other Buddhists, much of their practice of meditation is, at the heart, about removing fear from our life and reducing suffering in our pain. So how do we remove that very ingrained sense of fear? That's hard because fear is such a part of our evolutionary heritage. If you think about it, we are all here today mostly because our ancestors were really good at sniffing out threats. It wasn't the cool, calm, relaxed cave people that survived, but the anxious ones. Our brains are primed to be vigilant, fearful, and anxious about impending doom. Removing that fearfulness right requires, in part, according to Buddhist philosophy, a concentrated effort to see things as they really are, apart from our delusions of how our fearful brains interpret it. This is the central tenet of Buddhist practice. These ways of seeing things aren't really about religion, although some take them that way, but more secular truths based on wisdom. One is the wisdom to see that everything is impermanent, including me, myself, and I. So we can relax into things such as aging, sickness, and death. A second is to understand our basic interconnectedness, that the deeper we reflect, the more the lines between me and you become blurred, and this separateness we often feel is based more on fear than perhaps actual reality. A third is that we can step out of fear by recognizing that pleasurable things don't last, but neither do unpleasant things, and so fearing the loss of pleasure or the coming of displeasure actually creates a lot of unneeded suffering in our lives. And when we begin to raise our awareness to see beyond fear, we will more naturally and easily be able to express the kindness that most of us aspire to.
selfish. Altruism is an illusion. Cooperation is for suckers. Competition is natural, war inevitable. The bad in human nature is stronger than the good. Now, I've been in this congregation long enough to know that that's true about every single person in this room. Why is that? Because we're human. But today, I want to give you a little taste of the scientific evidence, new scientific evidence, that shows the other side of us, the good nature of humans. And that this other nature is just as intrinsic as the bad side. My information comes almost entirely from this book, The Compassionate Instinct, The Science of Human Goodness, edited by Dr. Keltner, Jason Marsh, and Jeremy Adam Smith. It is a collection of the best essays from Greater Good magazine, which highlights these exciting new scientific research and fuses it with inspiring stories of compassion action. These essays are the fruits of radical new developments in science, new evolutionary studies of peacemaking among our primate relatives, neuroscientific experiments that have identified the neural basis of emotions like love and compassion, discoveries of how hormones like oxytocin promote trust and generosity, and psychological studies of how why people move to practice kindness even when it seems to cut against their own self-interest. What's more, these essays reveal new pathways to healthier bodies, marriages, workplaces, families, and cultures. For example, neuroscience suggests that when we give to others, our brain shows heightened activity in the nucleus accumbens, the same region that is active when we experience pleasure, such as food or sex. In other words, kindness is really its own reward. Kindness is also contagious. Research finds that when we offer modest expressions of gratitude, the simple thank you, a smile or a warm gaze, we prompt other people to reciprocate the kindness toward us and toward others. Moreover, it seems that being irrational, rather than being irrational and superfluous, behaviors like compassion and kindness are actually conducive to human survival and essential to human flourishing. This book is divided into three sections. One, the scientific roots of human goodness. Two, how to cultivate goodness in relationships with family, friends, colleagues, and neighbors. And three, how to cultivate goodness in society and politics. The first section contains many essays that document the scientific roots of human goodness. For example, let's look at a universal human experience, touch. Primates, such as great apes, spend hours a day grooming each other, even when there are no lice present. What is our first response when we see a dog? Dr. Keltner has done research to show that compassion can be communicated via touch. Have your arm. He took two strangers. He put them in a room with a barrier. Okay? They could not see each other, but there was a hole for them to touch each other. And he instructed the person doing the touching to touch the forearm of the person and try to communicate love, compassion, gratitude. And remarkably, consistently, the person who was being touched, thank you, consistently identified each of these emotions. And this suggests that this is really an evolved part of human nature. It came before words. And we have this experience to universally experience this across cultures. In another study related to empathy in 1964, rhesus monkeys refused to pull a chain that delivered food to themselves if doing so shocked a companion. One monkey stopped pulling the chain for 12 days after witnessing another monkey receive a shock. Those primates were literally starving themselves to avoid shocking another animal. Another researcher discovered that the only way to get her pet chimpanzee off the roof was to arouse sympathy, to pretend that she was hurt. This was much more effective than any reward or threat of punishment in getting the chimpanzee off the roof. There were these two assassins waiting for their victim to come home. They had studied his patterns, and he usually came home around 7 p.m. So they were anxiously awaiting for him to do their dastardly deed. Soon, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock came. No victim. So the one assassin turned to the other and said, "Gosh, I hope something didn't happen to him." While that was clearly a joke, in reality, during World War II, a study conducted by the U.S. Army discovered that 1 out of 100 men along the line of fire consistently, out of 100 men, only 15 to 20 would take any part with their weapon. They would do something else. This study has been corroborated by many other studies. A French study from the 1860s documented that the common tendency of soldiers to fire harmlessly into the air above their enemy. It seems that even in times of war and under the military command to do so, men and women display an intense resistance to killing each other. This resistance can be so strong that many soldiers on the battlefield will die before they can overcome. I know that not long ago we had a debate up here in a sermon about forgiveness. Clearly, the research of this book shows that people who are capable of forgiving, first of all, they're capable of forgiving some of the most heinous things that have been done to them. There's countless stories of people forgiving rape and almost being killed. And those that are able to do that are able to move on with their lives with greater happiness and contentment. Forgiveness can reduce stress, blood pressure, anger, depression, and hurt. And it can increase optimism, hope, compassion, and physical vitality. Make no mistake, the desire for revenge is a built-in feature of human nature. But the capacity for forgiveness is also a built-in feature of human nature. In fact, reconciliation isn't limited to humans and primates. Goats, sheep, dolphins, and hyena all tend to reconcile. In fact, of the half dozen or so non-primates that have been studied, only domestic cats fail to demonstrate a conciliatory tendency. That's probably not a surprise to you cat owners. So to make the world a more forgiving, less vengeful place, don't try to change human nature. Change the world. We will see, and we have seen, more forgiveness in places where policing is reliable, the system of justice is efficient and trustworthy, and social institutions are up to the task of helping truly contrite offenders make amends with the people they've harmed. Another topic of gratitude is gratitude. And what I like to call it, developing an attitude of gratitude. Through regularly being thankful for all that we have. Including recording a journal, all the things you're thankful for. In America and the West, we take so much for granted. A scene from The Simpsons captures this mentality well. When Bart offers the following words for grace at the dinner table. "Dear God, we paid for all this stuff ourselves, so thanks for nothing." this book documents plenty of scientific proof that when people really work on cultivating gratitude, which is more of a state of mind than a single act, they experience a variety of measurable benefits, psychological, physical, and social, including measurable, transformable life changes, documented by not only themselves and how they feel about themselves, but by what others say about them. Lastly, life can become complete when we are able to take this gratitude and pay it forward to others. When we give to others what we ourselves have received in the past. In one of the studies, a 33-year-old woman with spinal muscular atrophy captured this dynamic. All of my life, people have been involved to assist me in getting dressed, showered, to work, school, etc. It was my hope that one day I would be able to do something really significant for someone else, like others have always done for me. I met a man who was married and very unhappy. He and his wife had a little boy born to them and then died at 7 months of age. For 10 years, they remained married, trying to have another baby. They were never able to have a child again. They divorced, and he became my friend and lover. He told me of his life's dreams of having another child. I got pregnant from him and had a miscarriage. I got pregnant again and had an ectopic pregnancy. No loss of my tubes, thank God. A shot took care of the problem. I got pregnant a third time, and our beautiful son was born on December 20th, 1998. I've never felt as grateful for anything in my life. I was actually able to give something back to someone else. Me, who was supposed to die before I was 2 years old. The second section of the book contains many essays that offer concrete, research-tested steps for building stronger, more compassionate relationships with spouses, coworkers, friends, family, and other people in our daily lives. It goes without saying that it can be difficult to take these steps, for human relationships are complicated and shaped by social context. Take, for example, empathy. Both the thinking component that allows us to take another person's point of view, but also the emotional capacity to feel what the other person is feeling. It's a skill that's a fundamental building block to our individual happiness and well-being, as well as to a peaceful society. But like many pieces of advice, the age-old adages to put yourself in someone else's shoes or see the world from someone else's perspective can sound painfully naive. Indeed, they seem to go against human nature, serving as moralistic attempts to rein in our tendencies towards self-interest. Can we truly understand what other people are thinking or feeling? And if so, how? Many of these essays explore the human capacity for empathy and how it is related to other behaviors like gratitude, forgiveness, and altruism. Fortunately, there's overwhelming evidence that most of us can develop empathy and gratitude, as well as forgiveness and apology and other related skills. The essays in this section do not deny that humans are capable of great selfishness and insensitivity, and there's sometimes no greater challenge than simply getting out of our own skin and identifying with another human being. But while the advice to see from another poor person's perspective may seem unrealistic, the essays make clear that it's advice we can all learn to follow. There are essays in this section for couples to develop an economy of gratitude when dividing the household labor. In other words, it's not that the household labor is evenly divided, but each feels that they're doing, that their partner's doing more than their share. The economy of gratitude. There's essays on how to develop more compassionate workplaces with your work colleagues, including the kind of language you should use if you're in a position of power. One of the most powerful essays for me was that by experiencing good literature or movies, especially when you take a non-Western view at them, you can really learn empathy by feeling the emotions the characters in ourselves. We're allowed to truly feel the emotions of others, such as the pain of the downtrodden, the anguish of defeat, or the joy of victory, but in a safe way. I know I saw many of you a few weeks ago at the movie, The Help, a powerful novel and movie about African-American maids in the Deep South of the 1960s. Well, I'm certainly no Minnie, a stout, black, sassy maid, but I was able to identify and experience her emotions, and I would still want to eat her chocolate cake. We need to remember that everyone in the world is more like us than different. That the bad guys, however we define them, once were children, now worry about their mother, like sweets, fell in love and have children of their own. Lastly, in this section, we learn that just as empathy has its downsides, like for first responders or nurses, negative emotions like anger can have upsides. Sometimes we need to get hot in order to help or drive change in the world. The third section details how if we act on the greater good, not only does it benefit our personal health and our relationship with others, it practically or symbolically promotes peace in our society and across all cultures. Reading these essays will not guarantee that you'll spring to action next time someone falls on the sidewalk, or that you'll immediately seek actions to tackle world peace. In fact, the inhibitions to actions can be overwhelming and sometimes justified. However, these essays provide insight into why we so readily and at times unconsciously assume the role of bystander. In the process, they help display some of the shame and guilt and confusion we sometimes feel when we don't demonstrate the courage of our convictions. Just as it takes practice to cultivate some of the other behaviors and emotions, forgiveness, compassion, empathy, we may have to work to overcome our tendency to sit on the sidelines. But as Zeno Franco and Philip Zimbardo argue in their essay, our capacity for heroism is as natural to us as our inclinations towards apathy. Nurturing heroism requires education, inspiration, and opportunities for reflection. Of course, no cure exists for all the problems that plague this planet. Just as there's no easy fix for a damaged relationship. But the science and stories featured in this book convey that we can always take steps in the right direction. They show us again and again how true political and social progress often stems from changes we can all learn to make in the way we relate to ourselves and to others. This section explores that most of us are capable of being bystanders or being heroes, with many studies about the influence of those around us in these situations. It's really amazing how those around us can influence us one way or the other. But just the fact that we learn about our own tendencies to be bystanders can help us to avoid that situation when it happens. Others' essays show us the individual health benefits of volunteering, especially after times of hardship or depression, by shifting the focus onto others and outside ourselves, or to learn how to give an effective apology. For all you pessimists out there, this section illustrates how we are now living in the most peaceful time in existence, where the chance of us being killed by another human being is at an all-time low, and how less violent our punishments are. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that live cruelty was a popular form of entertainment. To illustrate the range of possibilities of our behavior, I would like to read an excerpt from the book about the Stanford Prison Experiment. "35 years ago, a study was launched known as the Stanford Prison Experiment. 24 young men who had responded to a newspaper ad were randomly assigned roles as prisoners or guards in a simulated jail at Stanford University's psychology department. The prisoners were arrested at their homes by real police officers, booked and brought to the jail. Everything from the deliberately humiliating prison uniforms to the cell numbers on the laboratory doors to the mandatory strip searches and delousing were designed to replicate the depersonalizing experience of being in a real prison. Their men who were assigned to be guards were given khaki uniforms, mirrored glasses, billy clubs. The idea was to study the psychology of imprisonment, to see what happens when you put good people in a dehumanizing place. But within a matter of hours, what had been intended as a controlled experiment in human behavior took on a disturbing life of its own. After a prisoner rebellion on the second day of experiment, the guards began increasingly degrading forms of punishment, and the prisoners became more and more passive. Each group rapidly took on the behaviors associated with their role, not because of any particular internal predisposition or instructions from their experimenters, but rather because the situation so powerfully called for the two groups to assume their new identities. Interestingly, even the experimenters were so caught up in the drama that they lost objectivity, only terminating the out-of-control study when an objective outsider stepped in, reminding them of their duty to treat the participants humanely and ethically. The experiment, scheduled to last 2 weeks, ended abruptly after 6 days. While this demonstrates the banality or commonness of evil and how easy we can go there, the final essay in the book makes the case for the banality of heroism. That almost any of us can become heroes when put in the right circumstances and have the courage to act on our conscience. How many times have we seen the interviews of, quote, heroes, and they all say the same thing? I didn't do anything special. I did what anyone would do in my position. We've all heard many stories of heroism regarding the tragic incidences surrounding 9/11, regarding the firefighters, the rescue workers, etc. But what about others, such as someone right here in Hartland, whose son-in-law volunteered several weeks of his time to utilize his demolition skills to remove the rubble of the towers? He wasn't a member of the National Guard or the military, but simply gave weeks of his time and salary. But what about those who simply speak up against unfairness at the risk of getting fired or ostracized? They are heroes also. Today I just gave you a taste of all the powerful information, the data, and stories in this book. But I'd like to close with my own personal take. This book was a powerful reminder to me of how I fall short, of how, especially when it comes to acts that require real work and hard work and real effort. I think about this group of people here, about Tom, who worked so hard for Habitat for Humanity, or for people who brought undies today for the Hope Center, or do other hard work for the Hope Center, or other acts of social justice, or teach our kids in RE, or serve on one of our many committees. Lastly, I'd like to thank Tracy, Greg, John Kuhn especially, and Carrie for their help in preparing this service. And I'd like to thank Jeanette Stoller, who read the book with me twice and critiqued my sermon multiple times. And for Kim, who bid on this in the silent auction, which is coming up again. Now, through this book and sermon and experience, maybe it'll make a difference.
Sharing those insights, Mark. That's very interesting. Freely have we received of gifts that minister to our needs of body and spirit. Gladly now we bring to our church and its wide concerns a portion of this bounty. The ushers will now pass the baskets, and if you're a guest today, we hope you have enjoyed the service, and we welcome you with no sense of obligation. Insights from the service today. I think we've got mics that can be passed. And just tell us your name and be brief so there's maybe time for a few.
I'm Kim, and I'd like to thank you, Mark, for taking the assignment and the auction item. I thought it was excellent. Two things that I really appreciated about it, the first one being an English major writerly type, the underlining of the power of literature to create empathy is really exciting for me to be reminded of, and also just that whole, the ripple effect of the kindness that we do in small ways, reaching out to the rest of the world. I really appreciate that message, so thanks.
Thank you, Mark, for the sermon. My name is Carlin. I just wanted to share, someone had given me a mother book, like those little blurbs about motherhood and all when I was raising my children. And one that had stuck with me, which is pertinent to today, was the greatest gift that a mother can give to the world is to raise a compassionate child.
Well, I too, Mark, thank you for your words on this. They're really very, very well written, very well presented. I hope you publish it. Ready for one? I'm serious. But I do have some concerns. I'm just seeing a darkening of the so-called culture war going on in this country, where animosity towards gay and lesbian people has become an article of faith among political candidates for president. And I hear presidential debates punctuated by cheers to questions about putting prisoners to death and about letting people who don't have health insurance die. And I hope we can find a way to overcome this.
And I think, you know, those messages are out there, right, consistently, independent on what we choose to watch and see. And I think it's up to each of us to get to know people who have a different opinion than us, to talk to them, to understand they're people too, and they have ideas, and try to convey where we stand and where they stand, and just get to know each other.
Thanks, Mark. That Kim Soar, she's such a joker. She gave you a topic like that. You did a really nice job with it. I have to say that I felt a little uncomfortable in the beginning with this. I thought toward the end I could feel better about it, but toward the beginning, the talking about the science and the studies, and first of all, I didn't think they were recent. It sounded like they were 60s era.
The quotes I took were, but
it seemed pseudosciencey to me, and it also seemed a little evangelical green jacket trying to enforce our beliefs into the science.
Okay.
The way that religion tries to tell us whether or not there's evolution, for example. I don't think that we should, as even as Unitarian brand religious people, look to science for our beliefs, and I fear that those studies suffered from that a little bit. And part of that, I sensed the rigidity of my wife next to me, who's a biology professor who studies, whose degree is in animal behavior, and I'll let her speak if she cares to, but I know that she brings home stories of her own students with things like that. So I appreciate the sentiment. I like the idea of it, but I'm not sure that the science is valuable.
Just a couple comments. Unless you want to say something. Part of that could be the way I presented it to some extent, because I didn't want to bore people with a lot of the scientific facts that are in there and some of the detail. And the names of researchers and the number of experimenters and some of that kind of data. I wanted to go with some more stories and some more humor to kind of lighten it up. So it's possible that could be, like you said, but I think there's a lot of science that seems to be showing some of the similarity of these things. So,
hi.
Last comment.
I'm Leanne. Thank you, Mark. That was wonderful. Over here.
Gotcha.
A little bit in response to that, I wasn't going to say anything, but I had some wonderful opportunities when I was young that were similar to what the kids get here in religious education, to be able to help other people in my community. And I just want to say that I actually have a physiological difference when I take the opportunity to help other people or give. And if I don't do something within a 6 month to a year period, I can tell I get more depressed, I get boring, you know, I have a real physical, I can tell that my life is lacking something, so I have to actually make myself get out and do something for somebody else. So I totally understand what you were saying and appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. Okay, I'll wrap us up here. Remember, we're capable of almost anything, from the most selfish evil to becoming a hero by giving our life for another. I urge you to read this book. If that's not enough, get the scientific studies themselves, see what they're about. Read the magazine. Simply start a gratitude journal of your own, the things that you're thankful for. Do it for 3 or 4 weeks and see what an amazing difference it can make, like it did for the people in this book. See or read The Help, the movie that's out there now, or other great literature, like Kim said. You know, there's tons of great, powerful literature that's fiction and nonfiction, but allows you to really empathize with people who have suffered tremendously. But the main thing is to kind of cultivate that compassionate instinct that's within us. Make our world and our personal lives, at work or in the world globally, a wonderful, peaceful place to live in.
Down and out, but in the helping hand.